You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And we're just a couple of minutes late with today's edition of the M Squared TechCast. Minor technical glitch, but we've got it fixed now.
We do indeed, and we have calling in. I'm not sure exactly. I know Kate booked you guys. I'm not sure what city. Are you down in Atlanta?
Atlanta, exactly.
John Tipton and Emily Blum. And you guys are working on the relief effort down there. COVID-19, of course, is the topic for everyone, topic for us lately. And so let's talk a little bit about what you guys are doing down there. Give us a kind of a quick overview.
Yeah, so we are kind of leading a couple subsectors of efforts. We're working on getting PPE production on a larger scale, production-wise, for both face shields, N95 respirators, and a couple other projects. So we're working as kind of an engineering group that usually focuses in the med tech sphere. So we're trying to get these products designed in a better and safer way, and quickly get them out to the folks that really need them.
And we're focusing not just on Atlanta, but we're looking at a national scale and potentially even international once we start ramping up our operations.
Absolutely.
All right.
So specifically, what are you making in this effort?
So we started off with a quick win project, and that quick win project was something that was going to be easy to design, easy to manufacture, although we've learned some lessons along the way in the few short weeks that we've been doing this. In 6 weeks, we've managed to design with the help of Georgia Tech and manufacture with the help of Siemens, ExxonMobil, and Delta, large-scale manufacturing of face shields. And John is leading the charge for reusable N95 respirators.
All right, great. So 3D is really big. I know that's what this really drives is how much production are you able to actually do with 3D?
So good question. So we use 3D printing pretty regularly in our day-to-day operations. So our perspective, 3D printing is the great new technology of the age. I think it became pretty apparent quickly that 3D printing, however, wouldn't quite fully cut it for production scale, as well as some material and design concerns that you would have with some of these PPE equipment, especially that we're filtering air through. So we are doing all of our production as a non-3D printing focus, but we did use 3D printing to help rapidly scale and iterate on designs.
Okay.
All right, so are you using injection molding then, or how are you doing the production?
So with the face shields project, we're using injection molded bands as well as some die cut shield materials. And then for the actual respirator projects, we're doing both thermoforming, injection molding, as well as various die cutting processes as well. So standard industrial processes that you would use for under a normal non-crisis time.
The other thing to note, too, is that we made all of our face shield information open source. You just have to go onto the GCMIATL.com website, and anyone can download it. And so there are quite a few 3D printing houses that have turned around and taken our design and adapted it for 3D printing and are now manufacturing it from that. So we're trying the injection molding mass manufacturing. But any maker out there that wants to contribute, they can do so with our design as well.
Do you have any idea how many makers you're working with or what sort of volume is coming out of all this? It's hard to tell, right?
For the face shield itself, I haven't checked the statistics in a while, but over 50 groups have downloaded the face shields. I don't know, John, if you know the last count for the face shields themselves. I think that we're probably quickly approaching 100,000 face shields, if not more.
Well, that's great. And then who are these, who are receiving this? Whoever the maker is working with locally, is that what's going on?
If they're local makers, they'll work with their local hospitals. We've established a network throughout the country. We've been shipping up face shields up to New York. We've been shipping face shields to Children's National, locally in Atlanta, as well as South Carolina also.
Yeah, that's obviously one of the big challenges, is trying to figure out who needs these and how to get them. And everyone's looking, but it seems like there's still a little bit of a disconnect between actually getting them out to folks. So we're working on tackling that through networking and communications through the university, as well as some of our other partners as well.
So what do you see as the role of 3D printing as a technology in this crisis, both in this crisis and sort of in more normal times for medical device development?
So yeah, we do, actually one of the products here at GCMI we've worked on previously is almost entirely 3D printed surgical device. So we do see 3D printing as a potential manufacturing method moving forward. But it's just really crucial to consider some of the material properties, the strengths, the actual degradation of the materials, just like you would for any other process. So it's great for iterating on things, but you do have to take into account some of these trickier characteristics as you try to move into a production model. There's a lot of variability in printing usually.
Exactly. And to echo that, you know, people that want to help out that have 3D printers, 3D printing networks, you can do good, you can help out, but this is a time-consuming process. I know I've worked with some manufacturers initially through all this before the cloth face masks were a thing, and they had made thousands of cloth face masks and went to drop them off at their local hospital, and the local hospital said, we don't want cloth face masks. That was at first. So if you are trying to get together a maker network and really try to scale up manufacturing of any product, really important to contact your local hospital first. Make sure that there's a need before you waste supplies, time, and your own money. Make sure that you're building something that they're willing to accept. Just because they need it doesn't mean they're willing to accept it made by the general public.
Yeah, I guess that's the tricky part, right? Because obviously they want these to be the right stuff, something that's safe. And are they looking to work with people they've worked with before? Of course, these are extraordinary times. So there's probably not many people out there they've worked with before in this particular space, right?
They want for the most part, they want to work with someone that they know is a trusted source. GMP, good manufacturing standards, are always appreciative, but they're not necessarily necessary for things like the face shield. For the respirator project, absolutely. These are going to need stricter guidelines, and some of the N95-like models that are out there that are 3D printed are slightly troublesome, because I think it gives, unless they really have NIOSH-approved standards and NIOSH-approved filters, they're not true protection devices.
Yeah, that's the tricky part. But these would be suitable for the average public, though. If the average public wanted to use them, that would be fine?
Absolutely. Yes.
So some of the things we've been discussing with the FDA, their big perspective through all of this is trying to make sure that products that are going both the general public and the hospitals, they're accurate in their labeling. So if I say this is an N95 product, I've got to go through all of the testing, the sample sizes, all of the standards, and make sure that we can truly be qualified as an N95 product. So just with some of these things that are going out to the general public as well, it's important to make sure you're not overselling your solution. And we want to make PPE that works like PPE, not just looks like PPE. So
yeah,
we're trying to take that approach all around. It's a really good strategy to have also for general public distribution. Make sure you're being clear about what level of protection these would actually be providing. Especially to hospitals and other medical-related groups.
Yeah, one thing that I see a lot of on the internet is people saying, I 3D printed a face mask, it passed the fit test. And the fit test is only one of numerous standards that you need to pass in order to get N95 clearance. Mm-hmm. So yes, for the general public, passing a fit test is probably just fine, if not gives you better protection than a face mask, a cloth face mask. but for medical professionals, just passing a fit test isn't going to be enough. You need to prove the filtration capabilities of your device.
And a lot of these are under these emergency regulations, right? It's clearly when the emergency ends, you have to dispose of them, right?
Correct. I think they're still trying for the FDA to catch up, though.
Yeah. I think they're still trying to figure out what that looks like. Are they going to have to go through and actually recollect devices? They're not sure yet either, because these things would normally, a lot of them wouldn't be used under a non-crisis scenario.
Right, yeah. Well, of course, on the other hand, we don't know how long this is going to last. Mm-hmm. Folks are saying it could be 15 to 18 months before we have a vaccine. Who knows? I mean, maybe somebody will make a breakthrough sooner, but it's certainly unexplored territory, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I know you guys are on tight timelines. Emily, you have a patient coming in, so
yep.
Give the address.
Telemedicine,
okay. Why don't you give the website address where folks can check out your designs, perhaps download them and use them themselves.
So it's gcmiatl.com.
Okay. And John, you want to add anything?
No, I think that pretty well covers it. We're looking forward to it. We're heading into our NIOSH testing phases ourselves, trying to get our solutions fully quantified and out there to help the people that really need it.
Okay.
As a Beaumont-trained physician, I thank everyone that's out there in Michigan for everything that they're doing.
Oh, a little bit of Michigan there. That's nice.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. All right. Thanks very much for being on the show today. And we'll be right back with some more guests talking about what's going on with the COVID-19 battle. This is Mike Brennan.
And Matt Roush.
And you've been watching MI Tech TV.
As a Lawrence Technological
University. Thank you, John. Thank you, Emily. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thank you all.
According
to PayScale.com, when it comes to graduate salaries, LTU is in America's top 100. Be invaluable. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest at any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors,
faculty,
and coaches.
Thank you.
LTU.edu.
Michael, okay. I'm sorry I sent you the wrong link earlier. I thought we were reusing links, but my bad, you know.
No worries.
It's not Shannon O'Hara, I can tell you that right now.
In this world that we live right now, it's normal.
Well, yeah, we were a studio show before 4 weeks ago, so right. We're still kind of adjusting to the new normal ourselves here. So, are we back?
Okay.
And Michael, how do I pronounce your last name?
It's Ketzlack.
Ketzlack. Okay.
Ketzlack.
All right. And what you guys are working on is we're working with the NDS on service lines impacted by the coronavirus. And so how have things changed for you?
Yeah, so it's great. So our business traditionally is we're operating clinics. We operate fixed clinics and mobile clinics in primary care in neurology and cardiology space. And a lot of those things became non-essential, literally immediately when this coronavirus hit. So one of the things that we had to do, and with our 200 plus employees, is really be able to convert some of our assets, and those assets primarily being the employees, in order to respond and provide services during this epidemic. So one of the things that we're doing is we're asked by City of Philadelphia to provide radiology and cardiology diagnostic services in their step down unit that is taking COVID patients for the overflow of the hospitals. It's a FEMA run operation, military and city emergency services. So we've deployed that literally within 24 hours to operate that 24 hours a day. For folks like Consumer Power and essential businesses, we have our teams traveling throughout the very large geography to screen individuals, to test individuals, to make sure that current infrastructure is working properly. A couple of really interesting things from a perspective of actual testing for the coronavirus, using that PCR test with a swab. We are operating an entire triage line for Union County, New Jersey, and that's about 600,000 individuals. And we're able to take in calls, triage individuals based on medical decision tree, and then those individuals that would qualify for testing. And obviously, we have very scarce resources, so we have to make sure that it is the right people that are getting tested. Then those individuals are connected to via telemedicine to our physicians. Those physicians are consulting them, educating them, helping them to develop care coordination guidelines, and those that qualify for the testing and getting them scheduled into a testing center run by the county officials to make sure that the individuals that are sick, symptomatic, are coming in a very orderly method. So they're not waiting for hours and hours on end. And those very, very scarce resources are being handled. So that's kind of what we've been doing as an immediate response. And we had to work our team. I'll give them a lot of credit. They've been working 7 days a week, 8 days, if it's possible, 24 hours a day to really be able to deliver and convert for our traditional services to what we're doing right now. And then we're working, obviously, on coming back to work programs, which are so important for our economy to get that back and going.
So, Michael, for people who aren't familiar, why don't you tell them a little bit about NDS, where the company is and the services it provides?
Yeah, NDS, we've been in business for 22 years. We're a Michigan-based company, but we do operate across the nation. And we operate really, our focus programs are to provide radiology diagnostic services. We support hospital systems throughout Midwest and the East Coast. And then we also operate very interesting mobile clinics with providers. And the purpose of those mobile clinics is to really go out to facilities like manufacturing plants where people don't have access to primary care, and people that are not being managed for chronic disease, hypertension, diabetes, and get those folks engaged with primary care earlier on when those diseases are still asymptomatic. So folks are not showing shortness of breath and signs, and trying to identify them earlier on, educate the people on what needs to be done next, and trying to engage them into the primary care or appropriate level of care in their communities to get them managed, to get the workforce to continue to stay healthy.
So these mobile vans now, I think what I read from my notes was you're dedicating a lot of those to corporate folks so that you can return people to work, so that they would go through these vans. They would either be checked out as positive or negative or have a temperature or something. And then if they were okay, they proceed to go into wherever they're working, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So The initial response with testing being so limited and availability testing so limited, we're really looking at identifying individuals who are symptomatic. So, you know, right, had symptoms of COVID, potentially having a high temperature, identifying those individuals and getting them out of that space so other folks are not infected, and getting them to be quarantined, managed with a provider. The next phase of it we're really getting into is what you guys hear a lot about is the antibody testing. And primarily, antibody testing will probably be the key to bring the workforce back from a perspective that a lot of individuals with COVID who are asymptomatic, may have always been asymptomatic. And right now, the data is coming out where that's potentially 20 to 50% of individuals infected. With an antibody test, which shows how our bodies respond to potentially this virus, we can identify those individuals, then engage them with primary care, follow up with a confirmation of a PCR test, that seeing if there's a viral load and that viral load still active, and then hopefully manage those folks, help them to get managed and get them back to work.
So when the pandemic is over, and of course none of us know that, how are you going to use these then going forward? Will they go back to their original purpose or what? These vans, I mean.
Well, you know, I think that from a standpoint of the response to the pandemic is going to be over, but the fact that we're going to have to continue to have a safety program in the workplace so we don't have that second bounce back of folks getting infected, I think those programs are going to be in place for some time. The idea is how to do it so it's cost effective, how it is technology based, so you can identify these individuals and have technology help you track these individuals until they have, for example, two negative PCR viral tests, so they can go back to work. So those components are going to be there for our traditional business of chronic disease. we are integrating that type of testing before those individuals are seen. Again, from a perspective of making sure that the person's educated about what's going on. Have they ever been exposed? Are they potentially contagious now? And really, for our medical staff to be able to be safe in order to be able to provide those traditional healthcare services.
People have been talking about telemedicine for a long time now, 20 or 25 years. Do you think this pandemic might finally usher in sort of a new age of telemedicine, and what's that going to look like?
Yeah, it's so telemedicine has had a very difficult uptake for just a lot of reasons. Number one is it is extremely important for a patient and a physician to have a physical interaction. There's a lot of stuff that occurs there, a lot of communication, a lot of things that the physicians learn. However, with this pandemic, one of the things we've been able to learn is actually there's a tremendous amount of technology out there, and we can achieve a lot of medical conclusions using this technology. The fact that now, and I think that's going to be significant. I don't think that's going to change. I think that the fact that people are being accepting of it because of this certain situation, that will continue to change the healthcare. I think the healthcare as we see it right now with folks just coming into primary care offices will forever change. And a lot of our providers will have to adapt to this technology. And they've already adapted and adapted very quickly.
Moving forward, though, I mean, certainly there's a big section of the population. I don't know, it's a minority section of the population that doesn't either have access to the internet or may not have access to computers or any way of communicating through telemedicine. How are we going to help those folks? Any ideas?
You know, it's problematic. So you can have an interaction that is a telephonic interaction. However, in that situation, there's a lot lost. My personal family had a scenario, a medical emergency this weekend, and I had to take my father to the ER. And then when I brought him home, I set up a telemedicine consultation with one of our neurologists. And because of that technology, the neurologist was able to take a look at exactly what symptoms we wanted to address and he wanted to evaluate. Without it, you become somewhat limited. So there is telephonic option there, but it is never as good for a variety of reasons.
Matt?
Okay. Well, we got about 2 minutes left here, so I just wanted to give you a chance to sort of give your website, do a little bit of a shameless pitch here, let people know how to get a hold of you and the services that you offer.
Sure, you guys. Well, listen, thank you very much. Thank you for the time. You can go to NDS Wellness. NDS, like National Diagnostic Services, acronym NDSWellness.com. Please reach out to us. We can always reach us by phone at 248-476-6980. I appreciate the time, you guys.
All right. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
Michael Ketzlag from National Diagnostic Services. We'll be back in just a minute with another guest here on the M-Squared TechCast. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching MI Tech TV.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. Wharton's Technological University graduates earn a degree and a higher starting salary. In fact, when it comes to earning potential, the Brookings Institution ranks LTU fifth among U.S. colleges and universities. Be enriched. Be more. At LTU, possible is everything.
Salaries of Lawrence Tech grads are among the highest of any university in America. Plan a campus visit to meet the counselors, faculty, and coaches. Why wait? Find out more at LTU.edu.
Are you happy with the angle of the camera?
Technical University is all about opportunity. You learn beyond the campus, doing real-world research for top companies and honing your skills through co-ops and internships.
Your sister bombarding me with stuff while I'm the show, of course.
LTU, you know, so is everything.
I'm responding to her and then doing the show.
Among the highest of
she has a lot of information and energy. To meet with counselors, great that way.
Why wait? Find out more at
lcu.edu.
Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
We're back. And Mike Brennan.
And we're back with another segment of the M-Squared TechCast. Okay. And we have back with us again Shannon O'Hara, and she's going to tell us about her efforts in New York. I believe you're in one of the boroughs. Are you in Manhattan there, or where are you?
I'm in the Bronx.
Oh, in the Bronx. Okay. But you are part of the fashion industry in New York, and you're going to tell us a little bit about seamstresses and what's the male term for that? Seamsters, I guess. I don't know. Like teachers.
I mean, the whole, it's usually just referred to as tailors or, you know, there's different subcategories, but I won't bore you with all that.
Okay. Yeah, we were debating what to call you earlier. I'd call your brigade because I know not all of them are tailors. They're a variety of folks. So we just said, well, tailor is nice and generic. Let's go with that.
So, I mean, I think since there are so many subcategories, I've been referring to them as tradesmen, garment makers, garment craft people. Yeah, it's so nice to see you both. It's been it's only been about a month since I talked with you, and so much happens so quickly every day in the PPE realm that it feels like I haven't talked to you in a couple years.
Yeah, we're kind of operating on dog years here, I think, I'll tell you.
It's been the longest April that I can remember. So, yeah, we've been in lockdown for 5 weeks in Michigan, and we still have 3 weeks to go. So Matt lives with his wife, but I live alone. So the only interaction I have is through these calls and things. So,
oh, good. Okay.
But anyway, let's.
Not that you're taking it so seriously.
Yeah, well, you know. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about all the things that have transpired over the past month. Last month, roughly 30 days ago, you were just beginning this process, and tell us how it's gone.
Yeah, well, it has changed at a breakneck speed. I would say, honestly, I look back on that interview and I feel like I was like a naive young person. But, you know, a lot has changed. A lot of PPE has been made. And I'd say when we were just gearing up and just getting started and just reaching out to all, I have a lot of political connections in New York, you know, people that I worked on a lot of campaigns and stuff. And so we were just getting in touch with the New York City efforts to make PPEs and New York State's efforts to make PPEs. And since then, we've watched a lot of people try to jump into this realm and become PPE makers that aren't necessarily garment makers. And, you know, if you talked to me a few weeks ago, I might have been a little discouraged. I don't know if you would have been enjoying having me on it because I was seeing so many people that I kind of have been describing as people with dollar signs in their eyes that were trying to jump into this realm and get their cut. But here's the problem is that these PPEs are, they've been made in like Southeast Asian countries and very low labor costs. And now we're trying to make them, you know, bring the manufacturing more into the States. And that necessarily means higher labor costs. So we see these people that were trying to jump in. And I knew that they weren't garment makers just by having been in this industry my entire career. You can tell when somebody doesn't really understand what they're making. And but in the last couple weeks, my colleagues and I have started to notice, you know, the factories I'm working with and whatnot, these people are coming with requests that are just way too low to employ people with that. And if, you know, and our skilled laborers brigade doesn't want to be a sweatshop, but we can't hire people for less than minimum wage. I mean, we can't break the law. So we're starting to see those people that weren't the correct fits fail. And then the people like myself and you know, some of the factories we work in conjunction with, everybody starting to be the ones that people want to work with. So that's been exciting. And, you know, for that month that we were watching the paid work be so low, you know, I've been speaking so closely this entire time. I've had a great relationship with the governor of New York's office. And one of the first things that started to happen that was very sad was that the hospitals were refusing to buy. So that I don't know if that's an issue that anybody else has brought up. I listened to your interview with the 3D printers, which is almost a parallel group to what I've been, where they're like the professional 3D printers. I'm the professional garment makers. And then they have like the maker spaces and we have all the home sewers that have been doing a great job on their volunteer behalf. So in my many discussions with this governor, the governor's aides, they were saying that they were really frustrated that that they were being told by the hospitals they wouldn't buy anything that the state was making. So what we did on their under their suggestion was we just started fundraising. You know, we're working with a wonderful organization called Runway of Dreams that is a group that that makes clothing for people with disabilities. So we've been working with them to do fundraising campaigns and then to help with the disability community, which is a very ignored community. But we've made masks for several different groups, and not just in New York. We had a big push out that went to firefighters in California, and you know, it's been exciting. But so now that I'm starting to see the dust settle with these people that probably weren't the right fit for the garment industry, we're starting to see a lot more grants and investor opportunities. And so I think what's happening is that since it's so much more expensive to manufacture in America, but we are very aware that this is a national security issue. You know, it's not having manufacturers in America, as we've seen during this pandemic, has been a national security issue. So we're starting to try to figure out how to really seriously bring manufacturing back on shore. And I get the feeling from my discussions with New York State that they're doing it. I know LA, I know Detroit, I know that there's some different areas that are really taking this seriously. And so, you know, we have been finding that the investors and the grant providers are trying to fill in that gap between what people can pay for PPEs right now, because they didn't plan on having domestically produced PPEs, and the gap between what they can pay is being filled by grants and investors.
Yeah, there's a couple of organizations here in Detroit. I know there's a garment industry group called Detroit Sewn.
Yes.
That's been working on this, and there's also several of our auto suppliers that work in various sort of industrial fabrics that are used in the auto industry that I know are making gowns. I don't know about masks and face shields and stuff like that.
Yes, we've been doing gowns. Gowns is a particular, because it's a certain classification, you do need to have a FDA-approved fabric. And I think the last time I was here, I was explaining to you how difficult it is to get these medical-grade fabrics. But we're starting, you know, mills are starting to produce this stuff domestically. I'm actually quite optimistic about the direction we're going in.
Yeah.
Well, Ford is.
I mean, that's always been the downside of you know, global supply chains. Is yeah, it's great that we help China create a middle class, but on the other hand, what happens when China gets mad at us and they quit shipping us this stuff?
Or no, even what happens when China gets sick, you know,
yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's what this issue was. And now that I'm seeing like some domestic mills starting to produce fabric, we have the labor here. I mean, I have in my group 500, you know, we're starting to get more and more requests. So we're starting to do outreach. I am confident that the labor force is here. And we've even started to like turn our eyes towards, you know, this is where we're at in the moment. I told you where we were, where we've come to, and where I see us going is to start to seriously talk about manufacturing in regional efforts. It can't just be New York, Detroit, and LA. I mean, each region needs to have a you know, so we've been looking into possible factories we could grow, you know, finding spaces and things that we could do in the future.
Cool.
So that's the good news. We may be bringing some of this stuff back on shore then, as it were. And because I know, well, a long time ago, 100 years ago, the textile industry was in New England, then it moved to the South, and then it moved offshore, again, chasing cheap labor, right?
It was less than 100 years ago. I think we were making the majority of our clothing up through the 70s in America. So we have done it. You know, it's kind of like you're in Detroit. You understand the car industry. It wasn't that long ago. And we do have the skilled labor here, you know. And what we're trying to do now is the issue is that when we get past this initial crisis that we're all trying to just run and catch up and kind of build the plane while we're flying. We have to start discussing as a country onshoring manufacturing, because it is a national security issue. Mm-hmm. And you know, a couple of the, I have three other co-founders of the Skilled Laborers Brigade that you haven't met yet, but two of them are industry leaders in the sustainability movement. In fact, one of our co-founders, Rachel Kibbe, was just on the cover of Women's Wear Daily a couple days ago as one of the leaders in this particular movement within the fashion industry. And, you know, if we're going to start talking about climate change and issues like that, manufacturing is, it is important to be doing it regionally and at least within the country.
Yeah, I know you're right about how it wasn't that long ago, because I remember, I'm pretty old, but I remember as a kid seeing commercials for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, where they would have a bunch of ladies singing "Look for the Union Label," you know. So
that industry still exists. I mean, that trade union still exists in New York today. They're now called Unite Here.
Yeah.
But you know, we have this stuff. Americans are capable of this. We are people who get stuff done. You know, we're the thinkers, we're the hard workers. We have an American work ethic that is, you know, unparalleled. And, you know, sometimes we get called lazy, but I am a member of the working class. I'm a garment maker. You know, I believe in our working class.
Well, certainly that's a good case. Now, what do you still need that you don't have? I know you're looking for the correct materials, but that's very expensive stuff, right?
Yes. Well, you know, we have been, when we last came on, we were trying to figure out how to, we were thinking the government was just going to step in, or a hospital is going to step in and help us buy a large amount of fabric. And then we would go with that. And what we're starting to see is that the model that's starting to work is that, you know, everybody wants this stuff. Everybody keeps coming to me, will you make it, will you make it? So I'm starting to like field some of the more dire, let's say, purchase orders or donation requests, and then taking them to people who are offering grants or investors and saying, you know, can you help us fulfill this? And also, I believe that the differences between what people can pay and what is needed are going to start to shrink, because I think people are starting to realize, like, it just costs more to make stuff in America. And, you know, we've been dealing with hospitals that were just so shocked by, when you buy, let's use gowns as an example, you can buy a pack of 100 gowns for like $15 that were manufactured in China. When you manufacture a domestic gown, first of all, it's fabric. It's not disposable. And it can be $20 to $30 per gown. So, you know, you can see why the hospitals have been shocked. But the good news, I mean, if we're going to go back to the sustainability argument, is that these things are reusable. You know, they're not being thrown away. They can be laundered. This is how we ran our hospitals before we decided everything should be disposable. You know, it's not, this is a method that, or a way we can go back to. And I believe, like, I know Governor Cuomo seems to feel this way, but I'm sure other governors have felt this, that it's the national security problem. We have to start doing this.
Okay. And so if folks want to reach out to you, Shannon, if they want to support you or want to give you orders, or as our mutual friend says, purchase orders, how do they do that?
you can look at our website, skilledlaborersbrigade.com. We do have some contact information through that. You could, shoot us an email, or, yeah, that would probably be the easiest way. We have Instagram and, you know, at Skilled Laborers Brigade. We've been doing some fun little fundraisers and stuff with some of our partners. But I think it would probably be easiest just to go onto the website.
All right. Thanks very much, Shannon O'Hara of Skilled Laborers Brigade. We hope we can help you out. And continued growth and success to you. We'll be back with another segment of the M Squared TechCast in just a moment. Right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're watching at MI Tech TV.
What do you get at Lawrence Technological University?
All right, Shannon, me.
Hey, guys.
Great labs, studios, supportive professors, plus a full campus
library. This has been one of those crazy technical shows, you know, so.
Be smart, be more, at LTU, possible.
Shannon, let me share.
Oh, there you go. If you want to stay and listen, just bring your university in America.
Plan a campus visit to meet with counselors, faculty, and coaches.
Sorry, I gave you the wrong link. I'm going to try to get Dave to use the same link week after week because it confuses me.
You're not only marketable, you're worth more. Yes, more.
Guys, can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just fine.
Great.
LTU is America's top 100.
Is everything okay to share?
Valuable. Be more. At LTU,
you got to ask Dave when you're ready to do that.
I will. Go ahead and ask your questions, and we're off and running. University of
America. Visit to he's all set to screen share. You can just start whenever he wants.
Okay, there you go. Did you hear that?
Okay.
Let's start with the introduction first, though, Fred.
Yeah. Hey, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And the joys of live television. We're with you on the internet at mitechnews.tv. And we have with us, once again, our now weekly guest. We call him Mr. Sunshine, Fred Brown. It's a beautiful the virus, right? You know. So anyway,
Dave Phillips says he looks forward to your appearance every week. So.
Oh, I've even brushed all my teeth. I'm ready to go.
He's he's hanging out with us on our show tonight. So.
Oh well, perfect.
Cool. All right. Well,
I'll take you through some of the things that I'll show on both shows. I think it'll be exciting for the audience.
Okay. Well, Fred Brown is an infectious disease expert. He's got a resume longer than both my arms. He's been working on this stuff since the early days of the AIDS pandemic, and I think before that, right?
Yeah, that about started it. 87. That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, he's been working on infectious diseases, their cure and treatment for more than 40 years now, or 30 years now. And he's going to share with us a few messages about things that you should and should not be doing during this time when we are, you know, knock on wood, we seem to have flattened the curve just a little bit. And but what's safe to do and what's not safe to do right now? So,
well, I thought I'd take you through a few things. I've been working with a few governments. Right now, I'm working with about 11 different state governments. Michigan's not one of them, but that's all right. Four countries and the Department of Defense. And as part of that, I had to get ready for a fairly sophisticated tool set. And so I built a very inexpensive one that people are thinking about putting on as an app. But I thought I'd show you a little bit about, you know, where we are right now in Michigan. And so this is just something that I put together, let's see, in the last like 10 minutes or so. Oops, I'll save it.
Okay.
And can you guys see the screen okay?
Yep, sure can.
Beautiful. So why don't I just... So this is Michigan at 2 p.m. today. This is my two-minute analysis. Are you ready? The first thing I wanted to find out is how many of those little guys are out there and how are we affecting them with our social distancing? So to do that, we look at a factor called RT. And RT is the effective transmission rate of the virus. And you can see here we are kind of mid-March. We started the analysis and we're coming down. And last week we were doing, we were doing very well, you can see. And then all of a sudden we started trending back up again. That was right around the time we had those kind of protests. It wasn't the protesters. It was really a reflection of how all of us felt, you know, about being cooped up. And so we got a little bit, you know, antsy on the first nice days. Now we came way down again, especially after Governor Whitmore came online and said, hey, it's important we do the social distancing. But this weekend we're coming just up again. So once this line gets below one, we're in good shape. That means the virus can't really reproduce itself effectively. Well, you can see that gray line is indicating how much confidence error we've got. That means we're not doing enough testing. So basically, we're right on the edge of, you know, being able to safely open up, not open up. We're kind of going back and forth. And if you look at how we're doing compared to other states, here we're about in about the middle. You can see that, you know, New York is ready, South Carolina is ready, Massachusetts. These are in front of that red dotted line, you can see the states that really probably could open sectors of their economy relatively, you know, safely right now. And then we're in the middle, so we've still got a little bit to do. We're trending well. You sure don't want to be, you know, in Wyoming or Arkansas right now. That's they're going to have challenges. This gives you a sense of where everyone else is. You can look at supply chains this way and so on. But and if you want to talk about any of these different states, you see the confidence intervals, this little line that is up and down. So right now our gray line, our overall gray line, is below the line, but our confidence interval isn't quite strong enough. And Vermont is also a gamble. You can see right next to us, their confidence interval is really low. They're not doing nearly enough testing to figure that out. So how many tests do we need to actually do? And that's this page. We actually need, right now we're doing about 3,400 tests a day in April 15th. We're probably up at about 4,000 now, but we need to do about 12,000 tests a day to really understand where we are with this virus. And they have to be properly placed throughout the state. Right now we have a lot of testing, down in the southern part of the state, but not very much in the upper part. We really should, if we can, get up to 25,000 as soon as possible. With that kind of testing density, you can really tell what's going on almost by the county level if you want to, which would be great. Mm-hmm. So that sort of tells us how we're doing with the virus, whether we're controlling the virus with our social distancing. And the next kind of set of questions is, how is our healthcare infrastructure doing, right? Because if we let things go and then all of a sudden we have troubles with the disease states, we kind of want to make sure that we're not pushing the envelope. So here's our peak. You can see we've gone through the peak on April 12th. So it's been 15 days. We had some steady, nice downward. We had little bumps here and there. But basically, we're doing well. And that really hits the president's check in the box for 14 days. Well, we were a little off kind of about 7 days ago. So we should really officially restart the clock. And that is sad but true. You can see we're a little bit short on ventilators, but this model actually overestimates the ventilator needed. So I think we're in pretty good shape as far as our infrastructure goes, which is great. Of course, our healthcare people are exhausted, so it would be bad to kind of start to come back up again because they've all had to work so hard in the past few weeks.
Yeah, I have a friend whose daughter is a nurse, and she's working at Providence Hospitals in Southfield and Novi on the COVID units, and she's basically working 4 12- to 16-hour days and then gets one day off. So those people are just fried. They're exhausted.
Yeah, and for us, it's not just the work hours. It's the stress. It is very stressful to be on the job like that and just watching and trying to make sure you're saving the lives and being. There's a lot of concentration that's involved in infectious disease that we have to keep up. Beyond all the time. So that's a challenge. It looks like we're through the peak, which is good. And the next kind of question you have is, well, how are we doing for death rates? And this is, our death rate overall, and I did this for Oakland County, it's 2.46, which is good compared to most of the other parts of the country. We didn't exceed our capacity to take care of people. You can see we're kind of through the peak. We've had a couple ups and downs, though. And so that's good. We're expecting... I think about I've got it on another chart, but we're expecting I think about a few thousand deaths, sadly. But hopefully we'll be able to pull that in back in order. So that's sort of where we are with healthcare. And the next set of questions you got to ask, let's go down a little bit more closely. So here's what it looks like in Detroit, and you can see Detroit was a tough area. We really had a hard time. This is a blow up of the area, and dark red means we're one of the areas with peak, and you can see that kind of gives you a sense of the, and these are all available online. I can give you a tool that I'll give everyone a tool who's watching today that'll actually be able to call up these anywhere in the country. So this is just Michigan, but you can get a sense of some of the things that people are concerned about with the healthcare. The next kind of question is, how is the economy doing, right? Because there's that trade-off that President Trump talked about, which is the cure worse than disease? And so this is what things look like. We're expecting peak unemployment to be about 22%, 23%. We're a little bit better than average at 22%. You can see we're at 19.6%, but our manufacturing sector really is taking a big hit. That's because it's so hard to socially distance and those plants are closed down. And it gives you a sense of what part of the economy is really having trouble right now and which parts of the economy are doing pretty well. And so this gives you a sense of that. And then, of course, if you're a governor, you've got to figure out, how do I balance that? Do I want to open things up or do I want to shut things down? And so the tool helps you with that, saying, okay, this is something that I did for a little bit more advanced for another state, but they wanted to keep their employment up between 84% and 60%. they created a target box. You can see this RT number here in the middle of the screen. If you start at 5 and you say, well, I want to get down to below 1, here are the kinds of tool sets you've got to work with. And you can see you have self-isolation, and that brings you down a little bit from normal RT, and you got quarantine, that brings you down a little bit more. And finally, you get to the point of social distancing. And in order to get below social distancing, you really have to start to close some locations, and you got to be really careful about which locations to choose. And that's how you use the economy to say, I really want to close down this one, but I want to keep this one open. So with this target box here, most of our opportunity to control and keep things in place, if you close the schools and ban gathering and keep people over 70 and the compromised patients away and you quarantine, then what you're really talking about is social distancing. So how are we doing in social distancing? And the answer, they actually watch us on our phones. You can actually see where people are at any given time, what they're doing. And so you can see that in February, here's your activity levels. And this is for Oakland County. We can do it for any county in the country. And you can see that, you know, we're going out to the park a lot more now since we had a little bit of time off. It's good to get some fresh air. But if you are going to go out in the park and it's really crowded, I would wear a mask and just try to keep yourself socially distanced. It's great to get some fresh air, some sun. But if you're in a crowded park, you probably want to try to keep this down or go to a different park where you can actually socially distance. Grocery and pharmacy, we're a little bit above. We're going to the shops a little bit more than most people in the United States are today, especially in Wayne County. If you look at Wayne County, they're actually shopping a little bit more than normal, believe it or not. So we probably should try to make sure we get things sent to us, shipped to us. And then if you look at the residential, this is typical for the United States. You know, we're at home a little bit more, so you're communicating with your neighbors a little bit more, going to neighborhoods, doing neighborhood events a little bit more, and you can see the weekend peaks. Workplace is quite similar to the rest of the United States as well. So that kind of gives you a sense of, you know, where we are, what we need to keep doing, and when we'll be ready to open. And this, I put this together, you know, and I can send you sort of the handmade version if you want. And then eventually it's going to come out as an app, I think. You know, we'll put it up for Apple. But you can get a sense at the App Store. So, but you can get a pretty good sense, I think, you know, what's going on. So what do you think?
Well, let me ask you the question. Governor Whitmer last week said that we're extended out to May 15th now for whatever you want to call it, the lockdown, the quarantine, which is a little over 2 weeks away. Using this data, is that about right?
Yeah, I think we're going to be in good shape by that point, especially if we maintain the social distancing. You can see we're pretty sensitive to weekends. We get together on the weekends a lot, and it shows and the RT tends to come back up over the one level. But basically, we're fluctuating between 0.6 and 0.1. If you can bring it down just a little bit, be around 0.5 and fluctuating up to 0.7, that'd be perfect. You know, that then we're really ready and we can really do some, I think we can be a lot safer about the way we open things up, especially if we focus on the industries and the things we really want to have open. You know, it would be a shame if we decided to, you know, there's some trade-offs you have to make, right? If you decide that you want to have a big event, then you're probably going to have to do, you know, and have a lot of people close together, then you're probably going to have to do something like shut down a big plant for a while to compensate for that. So you have to make those trade-offs as a group of people, say, you know, do we really want that or we really want to do that? And it really becomes apparent when you start looking at the data.
So no DTE Energy Theater this year, right?
Yeah. Well, it depends. You know, as long as you want to keep the electricity going, probably you want to eliminate the theater and move more toward keeping the plant open if you have a choice.
And for my friend Mike here, what about Michigan football? I've heard some sports leagues are talking about playing the games, but just having them on television with no crowds. I mean, can you see that?
I think so. You know, so the trick will be to keep the athletes healthy, you know, but I think,
yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah, that's a small enough number. I think you can test everybody, right?
Absolutely. And so when you want to keep these really important activities open, you just test everybody every day, you know, and you kind of get a sense of where you are. Anyone who's sick, they go into quarantine. Anyone who's been touching the sick person goes into quarantine until they're better again. And you know, I think we, especially if we're careful, I think we can keep that going. But you can't get the crowds in there, which is disappointing, obviously.
Yeah.
So no 5-day tailgates or anything like that, right? So
well, if you do it in your own backyard with your family, that's just fine, but not with a big crowd.
Okay.
Okay, well, Mike, then, I'll have you over for brats, but we got to stay 6 feet apart.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm ready. I'm absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Well, we've heard a taste of what he's going to see tonight. And when you do it in front of IT and the D, I'm going to give you a shameless plug there, Dave. And so Dave's on the board, but him and Bob also run IT and the D, which gets a huge audience. So you'll be able to tell a lot of people what's going on there, Fred.
Oh yeah, I'd love to go into the IT parts of it. I do a lot of the modeling. It's a blast, and we can get into some detail. It'll be fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we're out of time, and Fred, once again, we want to thank you for being on the show. It's always a breath of fresh air when you join us.
It's a pleasure, you guys. It's a pleasure. Okay. Have a great sunny day. It's beautiful out there.
All right.
Yeah, I think we're going to go for a walk right now. So thanks very much, Fred Brown. Thanks for all of our guests today. We'll be back again next Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time with another edition of the M Squared TechCast on MI Tech TV. For right now, it's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And stay healthy and stay safe, everybody.
And maintain that 6-foot distance.
6 feet and 6 seconds.
Yes.